A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the Fourth be with you all month and beyond.
What about my brand name?
Hello, Properly Howard fans. Welcome to another edition of Properly Howard. This week we're covering Cape Fear with the inimitable Robert De Niro. Hey, if you've ever considered becoming a Patreon member of the Lorehounds, I can't recommend it highly enough. Go to thelorehounds.com, throw a little bit of money their way, and check in for second breakfast. Super fun, totally worth it. Christmas is coming up, a great gift for friends. Check out the fine work they're doing with Ahsoka and Wheel of Time. And in the near future, keep an eye out for podcasts related to Dune and Edgar Allan Poe's House of Usher. All right, here's my conversation with comic Steve Osborne. So, Steve, now that you are a tattooed man, do you feel like you have more in common with De Niro in Cape Fear?
Which was wild because I always identified with him already, you know, every time I watch a movie.
Not the actor, the actual character.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I always felt like Max Cady was a misunderstood character.
Yeah, sort of the evangelical, couldn't read, learned to read, studied law, learned 17th century philosophers, white supremacist, former Italian with a Southern accent.
Right, right. I mean, if it sort of falls right in line with the folks that tend to encourage people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and this is what you get.
this is what pulling yourself up by your bootstraps looks like. We've talked a lot about Scorsese recently.
Yeah.
So I feel like talking about De Niro may be a good idea here. For men of a certain generation, he's the actor. He's like, no one can beat De Niro.
Yeah, he's like our Meryl Streep, right?
Yeah, right, right. He really is kind of the equivalent to Meryl Streep. Although that has fallen off, I think, in the last maybe 20 years. You know, sort of slowly pittered out.
Oh, the De Niro appreciation. Whereas Streep is still hanging on.
Streep is as high as ever, although I think she was just in Only Murders in the Building.
Yeah.
So that can't help.
Well, you think that's bad for her? That's a very well-regarded show.
Her love interest was Martin Short, Steve.
That's acting. That's as good. That's how good she is.
It's like playing opposite a horse in Secretariat.
or Hot to Trot, starring Bobcat Goldthwait and Dabney Coleman, and John Candy as the voice of Bob.
Yeah, so I don't know how you feel about De Niro. I mean, I think in recent memory, his work in comedy has been as prolific as anything else.
Sure. It's interesting about De Niro, right? I mean, like he makes an appearance in Joker, right? Like there's still,
well, there's like kind of an homage to
King
himself,
of Comedy, right?
Right? Yeah. Well, himself and Taxi Driver.
Sure, right? Yeah, I guess that you get kind of a two combo, right? Yeah, I mean, so De Niro, I mean, I think De Niro still has the gravitas, right? I mean, I think he's the question is, has he become a caricature, or is he like still just staying relevant in a way that like maybe he wants to, right? I mean, that's I never get the sense with De Niro that even when he's doing something that we might consider like beneath him because of where we put him, it's like, well, I mean, to still maintain any level of relevance, like in your 70s, it's gotta be pretty remarkable, right? I mean,
Yeah, did you see The Irishman?
I watched enough of it.
It's pretty great, and you should probably watch it if ever,
Sure.
like,
If ever
you know,
I have a week.
you got a plane ride to Australia or something.
Right.
He's pretty great in it, and he's doing the De Niro thing. I don't understand why it's as long as it is. For anyone think, well, De Niro kind of lost it somewhere along the way. I felt like this is not, I wouldn't say it's as good as everything he's done, but he still has the chops. So.
Yeah, I think he does. And I think he does have the comedic chops. And sure, he may be in some lame stuff, but I mean, I think I'd have to look back at his career. I think if we
Well,
really
you don't
looked
have to
at
look
it.
back. I can tell you the exact moment.
Oh, okay.
It was like he was Meryl Streep, and then he did Rocky and Bullwinkle.
That was it. It wasn't Frankenstein.
Oh no, it was Rocky and Bullwinkle. Right then and there, it was sort of like, well, I guess that ended. That was pretty quick. It was like Russell Westbrook. It was like,
You're
wow,
MVP and now you're just poison.
you were historically good 5 minutes ago.
Well, but I mean, to his credit, like he's kind of, I mean, like was this after or before Meet the Parents?
Oh, this was before.
Yeah, so Meet the Parents is a good, like, I mean, that's great De Niro.
That's great, De Niro, but it was like all of a sudden, we are not going to mention you in the same breath as Streep anymore.
Sure. But I think he was bailed out by Pacino doing Pacino for so long too.
It's like
'Cause
you're
like,
not going to see Daniel Day-Lewis do Meet the Parents. But for De Niro, it was sort of like, oh, he could do this too. That's a nice feather in his cap because we weren't sure about him anymore.
yeah, because I think Pacino had become such a caricature that it was the concern at this point was like, well, maybe De Niro's just following the same because I mean, the Meet the Parents thing did feel a little bit like he was kind of having fun with maybe some of his previous characters.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But I think that there's a self-awareness to that, right? Like, because he still sold it, right? Like, I mean, he had really funny
Meet
moments.
the Parents is really good and I think holds up. And I think a lot of the reason why it is funny is that we saw him in movies like Cape Fear.
Right.
So it's almost like De Niro's filmography makes Meet the Parents even more funny. In the same way that sort of like The Freshman can't work, the movie The Freshman with Matthew Broderick, it just doesn't work unless Marlon Brando is Marlon Brando.
Sure.
That is the gag that he's putting in
Right.
those
No, that makes
movies.
sense.
So, all right. So, De Niro in I just recently watched Bronx Tale for the first time. De Niro is just freaking amazing in this movie. He's just so good. And he's playing off type. You know, he is playing an Italian in the 60s or whatever, but he's not playing,
He's not the heavy.
yeah, he's not the heavy, he's not playing the guy in Goodfellas, he's not playing Taxi Driver, he's not doing Cape Fear, he is something different. And he's really, really good. And watching this movie right after Bronx Tale, it took me back. I really remembered this guy was the gold standard for male actors for a good long 30 years. And this movie reminded me of that, even though this is not my favorite movie.
Okay. Yeah, I think he's fantastic in it. And I think watch it, because I've seen, this is probably the third time I've seen Cape Fear, maybe fourth. I don't like it anymore.
Oh, all right. Yeah, you were texting me last night. You're like, is this a good movie? I never liked it. Like, okay. I only saw it once. I was really disturbed by the cheek bite.
Yeah.
That to me, like at that moment in the film, I thought, this is not for me. I don't like this at all.
Odd. So the cheek bite moment was to this film, like watching De Niro in Rocky and Bullwinkle for the, like.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That was sort of the vivid image I got from the film, and it was very disturbing, and I never watched it again until yesterday. I did a double feature with Cape Fears yesterday.
Yeah. I did not get a chance to watch the original or any clips from it. I intended to. Which is really good for a podcast. It's intense.
Well, at least one of us did, and that allows me to kind of talk a little bit about the original. And you can pretend like you're interested for 2 minutes.
Sounds great. Just like our listeners. I get to have an opportunity to be just like them.
So I liked it. I liked the original Cape Fear. Based on a novel, and originally it was a Hitchcock. Hitchcock was attached enough to the film that he created the initial storyboards for the film. Then, and I don't know why, but he got taken off the film. I don't know whether it was him or the studio or whatever, but it was picked up by someone else who you'd never heard of. Then it really took on a film noir quality, and I'm not usually a big fan of film noir. So while I enjoyed the film, it was almost like a Twilight Zone for lawyers. That's how I felt about it. I don't know if you've ever seen the original Twilight Zone series.
Oh, yeah.
But it will take a concept and like it'll extrapolate an interesting thought, a thought exercise, usually toward the weird. Well, this one takes a legal concept and it extrapolates it. And the legal concept is, what if you have a criminal who knows the law better than anyone in the story, and he can go toe-to-toe with a lawyer and with a police officer, and he can, you know, walk right up to the edge of doing something illegal, but then know exactly what will hold up in court and what will not.
You just put the law in my hands, and I'm going to break your heart with it.
I got a little plan for your wife and kids.
They're never going to forget. Never.
That guy's kind of like a super villain at that point, because he can operate as freely as he wants to, as long as he doesn't actually break the law in such a way that you can prove it in court. This is Robert Mitchum, who's playing the heavy in this film, and he just comes across as someone who's physically imposing and really, really, really smart, which is hard to do. So for that reason alone, that film was interesting to me. Everything else about that film was kind of boring. You know, Gregory Peck is sort of like, you know, lawyer with a heart of gold, and his wife is completely uninteresting, and his daughter is unwatchable. And everything else about the film is not interesting at all, except for Robert Mitchum, who winds up in this movie, too.
And so does Gregory Peck.
And so does Gregory Peck and Martin Balsam. I don't know if he does anything for you, but he was the judge.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, I did think that I thought Scorsese's movie was certainly an improvement on the film in at least a few ways that we can talk about. But that is my sense of the film. It really feels like 62 in that it kind of feels like a 50s movie.
Got it.
Yeah, there are 60s movies like Cool Hand Luke that kind of feel like 70s movies.
Right, right.
This really feels like a 50s like film noir kind of film.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Have you seen Martin Balsam in anything else?
Let me see. Oh, yeah. He was in Psycho, right?
Yes, and I recently watched the first two episodes of The $6 Million Man.
Ah.
In that two-part episode of $6 Million Man, there's a close-up of Martin Balsam's face that lasts at least 20 minutes of that 40-minute show. Whoever the director was just fascinated with the Martin Balsam.
That's amazing. Fun fact, he was actually the original voice of Hal from 2001, but Kubrick decided to go another direction by the time hit the theater.
Wise choice, but that would have been interesting. Interesting. So a couple things about the original that made it into this film. A lot of things that are different.
Did Robert Mitchum also watch Problem Child?
Oh, was that the John Ritter movie?
Yeah.
No, he did not. And clearly that movie was just really tickled De Niro. De Niro just thought that was...
They didn't want to show just what a psychopath he is.
I like that. All right, so Scorsese is a filmmaker, right? And he's thinking, like, I need a guy who's going to basically be who the devil is to Job. What would, like, really torment me? Well, if I'm watching Problem Child with John Ritter, and there was a guy in the front row smoking a cigar and laughing in a way that ruined my movie-going experience.
That's right.
That guy's Satan. That is how he gets introduced to the Nolte family.
The first thing he does to drive these people nuts is get it to the point where they have to leave Problem Child early. Problem Child 2 comes out later, and they're just like, I don't know what's going on.
The monster. Because, you know, John Ritter is not going to be with us much longer, you know.
Could you imagine the Problem Child series is ruined for you? They're like, you know, like, hey, 2 came out, we could rent it. And they're like, I'm not ready.
Just whenever I see John Ritter, I smell cigar smoke. I hear that horrible laugh in my mind. Did you ever see Problem Child?
No, but I really want to now.
It kind of deserves the Howard treatment.
Maybe that's a theme we can do is movies within movies.
Movies that were shown in other movies is a great... Because
then it gives us a chance to talk about two movies, really, and like, well, why was that in that, you know?
Okay, a couple scenes that were in the original movie. You've got the scene with the car keys. That's cribbed directly from the original. It really is sort of like, how do I trap someone in their own car? If I can reach in their window, stand right outside their car door so they can't open it, take the keys, what are you going to do?
It's a big power move because it's like it makes the safety of your own possession questionable, right? Like it gives him power over his own shelter and escape.
Yeah, and if you make the move to get out on the passenger side, you've already lost.
Yeah, yeah.
The power is fully in the hands of the guy with the car keys.
You're trapped in your own security, meaning that you're not safe anywhere.
Yeah, so it's a great scene in both movies. It works in both movies, even though they're 30 years apart. And it really does give you a sense of helplessness, especially if at this point Nolte is still kind of has the veneer of a man of polite society.
Right, right.
Like, I'm not going to, especially in the place that I work, you know, I'm coming out of my office where I go in with a suit and tie. I'm not going to get in a shouting match with Robert De Niro in the parking lot. It really effectively introduces these, you know, kind of butts these two characters against each other. And it establishes De Niro as the kind of guy who knows that you've put social limitations on yourself. Mm-hmm. And he's going to take those to his advantage, which is the original movie in spades. That is exactly what the original movie does. There's the similar chokehold that De Niro does that was in the original. The rock in the hand on Cape Fear, and then houseboat in both, and then of course. It's Scorsese, so technically speaking, it's going to be really good, even though it's sort of not my bag. But you didn't like this, so maybe we should let you talk about that.
Yeah, I don't, since I don't have the original to compare it to, the sense I was getting is that certain camera angles and certainly musical choices were Scorsese doing some really on the nose homage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
To
it was the same exact score.
Right, to the point where it's like, I'm not sure what you're trying to do, because you're clearly updating this,
mm-hmm,
and giving it a much more gruesome and vulgar and just like a lot more graphic depiction of all the things that are probably not as such in the original. There was a need to do that, or a desire to. I'm going to update this for a modern audience with a real emphasis on the graphic nature of all this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to still try to make it like an old movie.
Well, and not only that, this is music for a film noir.
Sure,
but what you've done is you've updated it in such a way that it does not present as film noir, so the score certainly doesn't match the film. Although I'm wondering, like, Scorsese is famous for like just dropping the Rolling Stones into weird places in movies.
Right.
So I'm just thinking, like, Gimme Shelter in this film, like, where would that fit?
Well, I was already confused when he's got the video for Been Caught Stealing playing on the daughter's TV, but she's playing Guns N' Roses in the background. I'm like, what are you doing?
What is happening here? Scorsese really makes weird musical choices. Yeah, I wonder what this movie would be like if you just changed the score.
Well, the score is one thing, because the score was obnoxious. I mean, it was obnoxious. And I started getting irritated. And I understand that's supposed to kind of give you a certain sense of like unease, but not... You shouldn't be uneasy about the movie. Like, mm-hmm, you shouldn't be like, I'm mad at you, movie, which I was getting at.
Yeah.
And so I guess that was my thing, is just the incongruity of it. I'm like, every time he would do like a camera angle or a weird close up or something that would, you know, or we're going to get X-ray into Jessica Lange's nostrils for whatever reason. every time you'd make that choice, it would... It did like when, and then directors do this, right? I mean, this isn't necessarily new under the sun. I watch Winning Time, which is the whole story of the Lakers. And so they oftentimes go to like grainy, almost like old television quality or VHS quality to try to invoke, mm-hmm, that. And it happens periodically, but it does it in a way that feels like, I know it's stylistic, but I never felt taken out of it, because it was just done with like a deft touch, and I kind of appreciated it a little, mm-hmm, bit. And when Tarantino does it, sometimes it's so tongue in cheek, and you kind of know it's a Tarantino thing. So maybe I'm just more conditioned to it. But I feel like in many cases, it enhances the experience, because there is a playful quality to some of these things, even if they're heavier. Mm-hmm. But Scorsese doesn't have that. Like, that's not, Scorsese is like more often than not painfully serious. And so when he's making these noir choices or these throwback decisions, it's like, I just got out. Like, every time it would happen, because I'm like, you're making a movie that's intentionally modern. And there are moments, the scene where he's sitting on the gate or fence area and the fireworks, I mean, that's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous sequence, but it's just undercut by score. And I feel like it's undercut by like a following scene when that just feels super, you know, like throwbacky, and then you'll have a scene that's, and then it's just like so graphic at the same time. I'm like, well, what is this? Is this a tribute? Is this an improvement? Is this a retelling? I mean, obviously it sounds like there's much more complexity with the Bowden character in terms of the first two film or the first film in this one, because like you said, lawyer with the heart of gold, this lawyer is much more flawed.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to talk about the lawyer with the heart of gold thing. So the original film, Gregory Peck does play a lawyer, and the reason why the Max Kelly character is coming after him, not because he used to be his lawyer, but because one day in Baltimore, this particular lawyer was on the street and he saw this criminal assaulting a woman. So he was a witness at the trial, and that's what really made him a target. Now, he was in jail for something like 8 years, and he decided he's going to go after the witness, who happens to be a lawyer.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of like I studied the law as a self-made man in jail, and you studied the law formally, but we're up against each other because sort of happenstance has brought us together. In this film, Nolte is always sort of on the edge of being dirty.
Having an affair.
He's had a couple tennis dates, but just so much so that he can tell his wife that nothing happened.
Right.
And
right.
Like, you get the sense, like, as a father, like, there's that one scene where it's like, is he going to assault this child?
Right.
You know, so he's always on the edge of being a villain. And same thing as a lawyer. It's like, yes, of course, I buried this particular file, but I did so for the greater good. So it's sort of like, I did something a little bit murky ethically, and it's absolutely illegal what I did, but I did so for a better reason. And then you get Satan comes into the story, and Satan says, yeah, I see you flirting with the dark side. I'm going to drag you toward the dark side with me. And to me, that's a much more interesting story than the original.
Yeah, I definitely think that the story is a compelling one. And I think, I mean, the religious themes throughout are very intriguing.
And they're not subtle.
No. And especially, what I liked was there was, you know, clearly a critique on the American judicial system having some sort of a... Mm-hmm. A reliance on sort of Judeo-Christian ethics, so much so that I feel like it's a critique of both religion and the law, in the sense that we're like, we can sit there on both sides and be like, well, wait a minute, what Nolte's character did is the right thing, but at the same time, he took an oath to do it this way, and in a sense that's kind of the same way that maybe, especially if Scorsese is looking through a Catholic perspective, which we talked about through The Departed, mm-hmm. the sense of doing the right thing and maintaining your oath may be incongruous with the greater good in some sense, right?
Well, on top of that,
at least the way we see it,
you know, like we just shit all over this movie, but. In praise of this movie, you could read it as a critique of patriarchy, you know, mm-hmm. By way of rape culture. You could see it as a critique of the South. You could see it as a critique of Christianity. You could see it as a critique of the judicial system.
Mm-hmm.
So I could imagine someone really enjoying this movie because of those critiques, who aren't taken out by those other things we were talking about.
Well, and I think I should be one of those people. You know what I mean? And yeah. I think that's maybe one of the reasons why I was a little more frustrated with it, is because there were a lot of things in there. I'm like, I should be liking this more. I should be more interested in this than I am.
So would more John Ritter have helped?
Well, I think less would have, because what happens is I'm like, well, now you got me sad. They didn't know it at the time.
Because now you want to go rewatch all of John Ritter's filmography.
I need to dive into the John Ritter filmography. So it's funny because I didn't really get a chance, I think, until after the movie to put a lot of those things together, because I think I was just kind of just not really enjoying it. I felt like it was a bit of a trudge as I was going mm-hmm. through it. So then later I was like, oh, there's some good stuff there. But then it's like, well, yeah, but then do I really need Robert De Niro speaking in tongues to death? I don't know.
Well,
it's a choice.
Did you see the rat crawl over his forehead as he was going down?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, so I feel like the last time we talked about Scorsese was The Departed, and one of the things we were saying was that, does he ever write women, you know, compelling women?
Mm.
Does he ever write parts that are compelling for, you know, female actors? And watching these movies back to back, I feel like I really need to kind of, I don't know, mea culpa here, because in the original film, the wife was just really boring. The daughter was just, oh gosh, she was just a nightmare to watch. just these, it just reminds you, it was not long ago that women on screen were just one-dimensional, or however you want to say it. But in this film, I kind of felt like every character was kind of flawed, and the flaws made the characters a little bit more interesting. I don't know. I felt like the women in this film made it a lot more interesting for me in comparison to the original film. So just Jessica Lange, I usually am not a huge fan. I thought she was pretty great in this.
Yeah.
Juliette Lewis, amazing. Just.
She's great.
Just freaking amazing. So I don't know.
I guess.
I don't. I'm just going to say, just for a moment, Scorsese gets a little bit of credit in a way that I didn't think he deserved credit.
Well, I think maybe he deserves credit for making women more interesting than directors in the 60s did. I mean, if that's the praise we're going to heap, sure.
I'm saying that Juliette Lewis was amazing. Are you saying that
Lewis was an amazing, gave an amazing performance, but this is the, I don't think Scorsese necessarily gets the credit for that. In terms of being able to say that he does women better. Every woman in this thing is a victim. Every single one of them. Every single one.
I mean, look, Nolte's a victim here too, but.
He's still in charge. I mean, he's still the one he's a victim.
Like I said, I think
he's a victim by Katie, but they're all victims by him.
I think that this is a film that consciously is trying to critique patriarchy.
Right. I agree. I also think that it misses the mark a little bit because I think it in a way you could make the argument that says patriarchy is a problem because women can't do anything about it. And that's different than saying patriarchy holds women captive. Now, I think that there are moments of critique for sure where the clerk basically says, look, I know what women go through on this, you know, because we already sort of saw that with the file that said she was promiscuous, the original victim. And so, like, that's a compelling thing. So I felt like a good window into understanding why sometimes women don't speak up.
And just a note on that is an homage to the original film, but in the original film that same discussion, it kind of happens in a mansplaining kind of way. It's like it's, you know, it's like the wife who has no idea about the law is trying to explain why they should follow the law, and the husband who's a lawyer who's gonna decide to, you know, work outside the law says, yeah, but I've seen this happen. And he has to basically mansplain the entire, you know, situation of rape cultures to his wife. And anyway, so I did like the choice to wink to that, but do it in a way that was a little bit less mansplainy.
Sure. No, so I think the effort was there. I guess I'm just saying, I think that the daughter, Juliette Lewis is, I mean, like, she's, I understand there's this whole, like, you know, kind of budding sexuality and this and that, but I mean, I don't know if I totally buy the sense that she would still be somewhat interested in the guy that might have killed their dog.
But in that scene, De Niro, who's an adult and seemingly as conniving as the devil, convinces her that he's been misunderstood. He did not kill the dog. He would never kill a dog. That's a horrible thing that happened. And in that scene, I do believe that De Niro is compelling enough and charismatic enough of a personality that he could fool a 15-year-old girl.
Sure, a 15-year-old girl. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think she's fantastic. I think maybe Scorsese does a good job of portraying 15-year-old girls better than maybe adult women.
Look, you're not gonna make me like that performance any less. I could go with you that maybe Scorsese doesn't get the credit for it, but I will say that that was a critique I made of him, you know, last time, and after watching this film I think maybe I should take that back.
My thing is, at the end of this movie, Scorsese, I feel like I'm more Scorsese wants me to be more invested in the women only in regards to how they relate to Nick Nolte's character, as opposed to existing beyond. You know what I mean? I guess maybe that's where I stand. That, like, it's still, as flawed as Nick Nolte is, we're still, everything's kind of through his lens. And I don't know. I don't, I feel like, no, I mean, I think it's better.
Yeah.
I think it's better than his other work.
What I said before, I think holds. I think that this is a story about someone who's flirting with sin. And then you bring the devil into the picture and the devil says, I'm going to take you all the way to the dark side with me. And if that's the story that's selling it, it's a story about two men, and then you've got these auxiliary characters who are women, which, you know, you could say the same thing about 90% of all movies, right? So
sure. I'm not sure that I'm ready to do the mea culpa on the Scorsese thing based on this film necessarily, because you could make also the argument that, yeah, we're going to do the devil versus this man, and at the core of it, rape is used as a prop. And if that's the case, then I think that that's sort of missing the
mark. I would say rape is more than a prop in this movie. I feel like it's kind of integral to the plot, and I feel like there is a discussion of, is our legal system even set up to help women? I think that
I think it's certainly in there.
It was absolutely a theme in the first movie, and I think that this movie handled it even better than the first movie. And I don't know a lot of movies that try to handle, you know, try to take that on.
No, I think it was fairly done. It was responsible in that regard. But at the end of the day, like, this is a movie about two dudes.
That's true. Yeah, we agree on that.
So I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at, right? And so it's just if I was gonna do my best job, and not a very good job, but my best job of doing like maybe a feminist reading on this movie, I might say, oh, okay, cool. Once again, we're gonna talk about women's issues, but we're gonna need a couple of dudes to fight about it.
Well, and that's how I feel this podcast is about. I think that's why
people
tune in to hear a couple dudes, well,
or at least talk about ducks from space. Which I honestly, look, it's not my life. I'm only an observer. I will say this. Like, so Heather hated this movie. She was with it for a bit, but she didn't like it before. So she was reluctantly the room. But we both agreed that as uncomfortable as the scene with De Niro and Juliet Lewis in the in the theater basement is, it's the best directed moment in the entire film. Because there's no loud score, there's no funky angles. Uh-huh. Scorsese sort of just lets these two really, really good actors perform together.
You're not going to hurt me, are you?
I'm not going to hurt you at all. There's no hurting here, Danielle. Between us, there's no anger, nothing. Just a search for truth. I mean, did you judge me? Did you get angry at me when you caught me smoking the grass?
No.
But your parents, they judged you. They got plenty angry at you, didn't they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They punished you for their sins.
You got to give Scorsese some credit, obviously. You know, you're directing these two. You're putting them in the right situation to succeed. But I think it's kind of fascinating that the most, like, kind of unnerving to me, I mean, like, obviously the cheek sequence and all that, because of the violence, is so upsetting. But this is very unnerving, and it does so much to really give you, I think, a real good glimpse of how villainous this person is. And Scorsese was able to do it without X-ray specs or loud noises. And to me, that I think that scene took me out of the movie because it brought me into a movie I'd rather watch.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point. Is there a cliche, a trope, or a device that you enjoyed in this movie?
I love a good prison pull-up. I love exercising in your cell.
He was exercising right up until the moment he left.
Yeah.
He didn't pack his stuff. He didn't take down his pictures of Mussolini.
You know, all he really focused on was getting his comically gigantic cigar.
What was it? Now, I wrote down a few things that were on his wall here. He has a book that says Eat Right, Stay Fit. He's got pictures of Nietzsche and Stalin and superheroes. He's got a picture of General Lee. He's got a Bible. And he's got a bunch of legal textbooks. Right. And then, of course, his tattoos, the scales of justice. Truth right. on one side and the sword on the other side. Truth and justice are balanced. And then we go right into the John Ritter movie. So I thought that was fantastic. What'd you think about the De Niro accent? The Southern accent?
It's funny because it's like, I'm like, well, I guess that's what De Niro would be like with a Southern accent.
I thought it was really decent. And I thought, yeah. when I first heard it, I thought, oh, no, I'm going to hate this. Because the whole time I'm going to think, you're Robert De Niro. You don't have a Southern accent. I just recently rewatched The Big Chill. Mm. And Kevin Klein has a Southern accent that's just, it's so bad. It's so bad.
I love a bad accent in a movie, though. I mean, I love it.
I'm maybe in a movie that's not supposed to be good. Like, The Big Chill is right. like, revered.
Cape Fear, I think it's a movie I enjoy when I'm not watching it. because it's like, I think about it, and I'm like, oh, like, it's one of those where you put all the pieces together, or like, you deconstruct it like this, and I'm like, why didn't I like this?
Okay,
I'm
look, like, oh, that's here's right. what you could do.
Because I've seen movie. It four times, and I just tend to not.
Here's what you could do with this movie. You could pull out 8 De Niro scenes from this movie and show me them back to back, and I would think, oh, this is like one of the most amazing performances of all time. Mm-hmm. This guy is one of our great actors. And you put all of those 8 scenes in this movie, and I walk away thinking, not my favorite.
Yeah.
Is it Nolte? Is it the Nolte problem?
Hey, this is when Nolte is considered the sexiest man alive, according to People magazine. So, I mean, this is peak Nolte.
This is peak Nolte. For sure, this is peak Nolte. Is there a tweak that you would do to this movie to improve it?
Well, I think, like, for sure, the sound choices, score choices. And I would be curious, like you said, like, if there was none of that or less of it, like, what would that do? Like, would it take it from me from, like, maybe a C-minus experience to a C+? Or would it go higher? Yeah. I think it would be an improvement, but I think I would still have issues. It's a lot. And I think what happens is that by the end of it, I'm sticking into the houseboat just because it's like, oh, I've come this far. And it's like he can't be killed. It's like now it's like almost feels like a horror movie. So it's like I'm like, what am I watching? Right? Jason goes through very similar things, right? I mean, he gets caught on fire. He gets thrown in the water.
Well, he says in this movie, he says, "I dedicated myself to making myself something that was more than human." I think that this movie means to portray him as.
As the devil.
And I got on the soapbox last time and I felt vindicated watching this movie. There's no theological overtones or undertones in the original movie. The thing that Scorsese introduced to this movie that was not in the original was the hell theme.
I'm Virgil Castor and I'm guiding you to the gates of hell. We are now in the ninth circle. The circle of traitors. Traitors to country. Traitors to fellow man. Traitors to God. You, sir, are charged with betraying the principles of our frame. Can you please quote for me the American Bar Association's Rules of Professional Conduct, Canon 7?
You know, you've got the Bible represented. You've got the speaking in tongues at the end. And on the boat, he says that we're going to go to the ninth, you know, the ninth circle of hell. Again, I felt vindicated. This is what preoccupies Scorsese. He is preoccupied with hell, and these are the characters that are going to hell.
Yeah, and Cape Fear is probably one of his most joyless rides, right, to hell. I mean, there's not a lot of... I mean, when you're relying on a problem child scene for the comic relief, and it's not even a funny part of the movie, right? Like, he's just finding out how thrashed his house is.
if you had to go to hell, you're on a highway to hell, and you have Nick Nolte sitting in the passenger seat, that doesn't improve the experience, right?
Well, is this sexiest man alive, Nick Nolte, or current is that Gary Busey?
That's Nolte? More of an indictment on the state of America than it is saying something true about Nick Nolte. This is when we lost our taste generally. This is the same year they came out with Clear Pepsi.
We just were just grasping at straws. That Clear Pepsi won Sexiest Soda Alive.
Steve, is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard movie?
This is interesting. This is probably the most compelling question, right? Because on one hand, I go, I don't know that Ron Howard pulls this off with these themes in a way that is as effectively upsetting, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
I could have done without a couple of the upsetting.
Oh, for sure. And so I kind of like, so here's what I would say. I would say probably technically it's a Howard plus two, but for me, it's a Howard minus two.
This is kind of like when I'm watching gymnastics and like technically all the judges say that was a 10 out of 10. And I'm sitting there thinking, all right, well, I mean, to my untrained eye, sure, fine, 10 out of 10. But it doesn't make me like watching gymnastics anymore. So
sure.
I think that technically speaking, yes, this is Scorsese. He's one of our great filmmakers. It's not like I would have chosen different camera angles. I don't know enough to say it.
Right.
But I could recognize a few things that I just didn't enjoy. And so for me and my experience, probably Howard minus two.
Okay. So I think we're probably equally yoked in this, right? Like technically probably he got these performances out of these people, right? A director has to get some credit, right? I think.
Look, if I just take the 8 De Niro scenes out of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I'm looking at like a Howard plus 4, right?
Right.
But the whole there's something about the entire package that just was a misfire for me.
Yeah, and I think it's just, I mean, and again, I don't mind a movie that's sort of a joyless descent into madness. You know that. But I think just overall, there were just too many sequences that it just didn't make it a very watchable flick.
Was there a half the battle won to Gron moment in this movie?
I mean, move. Just move.
I think it's sort of like,
I mean, I know he could follow you, but like at some point.
I think that Scorsese is trying to say something like nobody's righteous. Like we're all dirty. Like whether you think you're a good Christian or a good lawyer or a good Southerner or a good male or whatever, you got your hands dirty and you are therefore susceptible to the devil. Like the devil's going to get you because of this.
Almost like just don't believe in a system, right? Like whether it's organized religion or whether it's the law, don't be fool enough to think that either of these have your best interest and your protection in mind.
Steve, you and I are writing a screenplay together. Is there anything about this movie that you'd like to include in our movie?
A little Ritter.
I like a houseboat.
You ever been on a houseboat?
There's something about a houseboat that I've built up in my mind. In fact, sometimes when I think of like what I would do with unlimited money, it would absolutely include a houseboat. I've never been on a houseboat and it's probably miserable. But for me, it feels like Venice. Like I've never been to Venice. I'm sure there's a lot of things about Venice, not desirable, but I've romanticized the houseboat. So no, I have not.
I've been on one. It wasn't moving. Nothing's great about it.
Did it just feel like a tiny house?
Yeah, it felt like it's like, oh, cool, a tiny house that kind of makes me a little nauseous.
All right. I like boats a lot more than you do.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
That could
be like water more than I do.
I love being near or around the ocean. I've recently, spent about 4 hours on a sailboat with a friend. There were nauseous moments for sure. So you got to be able to like that enough. Yeah, I like a houseboat in a movie. I like the idea of a houseboat. So why not? I like tattoos.
That's kind of how I feel. That's how I feel about books. I like books. I like the idea of books.
Okay, good. So for me, it's houseboats. For you, it's books. I like tattoos that tell me something about the theme of a movie.
Okay.
Tell me something about this person without having to explain it to me. A tattoo is it's a good way into that. Right. If I found your dead body washed up on an ocean and then I saw your tattoo, I'd be like, yeah, I would have been friends with this guy.
Okay. Well, I like that. Yeah. Kind of like a way a bumper sticker lets me know if I want to.
The bumper sticker still doesn't do it because I always think, did you buy this car used and just didn't take off the bumper sticker?
That tells me a lot, too.
It tells me something else.
Mm-hmm.
A tattoo. I guess you could say this guy got drunk and got a tattoo on a dare. This is exactly the kind of tattoo that his
which probably wouldn't be the case
funny.
With me. I got hammered and on a dare. I sat in a chair for 10 and a half hours.
this guy's hammered all day long.
Blackout drunk on the verge of death. He was getting his stomach pumped and then they just put ink on him.
I think we got ourselves a podcast.
I believe so.
And now you've got to go Robert De Niro on a Toyota dealership.
Yeah, I got several texts from Heather during this whole thing, basically saying that whatever I did,
you made it worse.
Did enough, so they're getting her a loaner.
Oh, good, fantastic.
I was pretty alpha this morning.
Well, you had just seen Cape Fear, and you were inspired by Max Cady.
Yeah, I kept on calling the technician at the collision center counselor.
Something.
He says, "Is this you, Mr. Osborne?" I said, "Maybe it's the big bad wolf."
Quoting 17th century philosophers.
come out, wherever you are.
If someone ever recommended a book of the Bible for me to read, I guarantee you I'm not going to read it.
A new Star Wars journey begins in the place all good journeys begin. At, well, the beginning. This Star Wars Day, I'm excited to introduce the new Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, where we will piece together the complete story of that galaxy far, far away, in timeline order, from the dawn of the Jedi through the great unknown following the sequel trilogy. This is a podcast for both Star Wars superfans and complete newbies. Listen to the short intro episode now to hear how it works and what to expect over the coming weeks as we set the stage for the new television series The Acolyte, which we will be covering with weekly breakdowns. Subscribe to the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast wherever you listen to take part in one of the most epic and expansive stories ever told, following all the twists and turns from start to finish. May the 4th be with you all month and beyond.